Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital, and I'm here today with Reed Thomas. Reed serves as the Managing Director and Chief Revenue Officer of JTC Americas, which we'll learn more about here in a little bit. Reed brings decades of leadership experience in both public and private companies, primarily in high-growth Silicon Valley technology company. So we'll see if you have any comments about what's happening with Silicon Valley right now in the Bay. Reed has been instrumental in the rapid growth of the company's EB5 and Opportunity Zone businesses, working to develop the purpose-built software solution and dedicated client service teams, which have propelled the company to leadership positions within both industries. Thank you so much, Reed, for joining. And maybe start off, where are you located right now as we speak?
Well, thanks, Jeff, for having me. I am currently in Jersey, which is not New Jersey, what the folks here affectionately call Old Jersey, okay, which is part of the UK family, I guess. And it's actually, though, technically closer to France than it is to the UK. So I'm 8 miles off the coast of France on a little island that's 5 miles by 9 miles long. Called Jersey, and I'm learning to drive on the wrong side of the road, Jeff. That's what's going on.
Are you getting used to it?
You know, it's funny. Yes, I am. Yeah. Except that the roads are very narrow. So I found that if I go faster than the other guy, I probably have a higher probability of coming out okay.
It's funny. My family and I took a trip to Australia, I don't know, a number of years ago. And when I got the rental car, the whole time I just kept staying in my head, stay left, stay left, stay left. Eventually you get it, but it is a little weird.
Yeah, it's easier when the steering wheel's on the opposite side of the car, because then you're kind of in the center, if that makes sense. That makes a big difference.
Yeah, yeah. Give us a little background of where you grew up, where you went to school, and then a high level of your career.
I grew up in Canada, actually. When I was young, I lived in Montreal, and then we moved around a little bit. Ottawa, which is the nation's capital. Toronto, eventually, where I lived for 10 years, and we started our family. I went to school. I actually took an engineering degree. So math and science guy, electrical engineering is my thing, computer programming and all of that. And worked for a while in that field doing engineering, and decided that that was pretty hard work. so I think I like maybe marketing and sales is more my thing. So that's where I ended up.
So how many languages do you speak?
I speak just two, French and English, of course. Yeah, so it's Canadian French. I like to think that the Canadian or the French Canadian accent is in France as much appeal as the British accent is in the United States.
But is that true? Is that kind of how it plays?
Well, to some people, yeah, they certainly know you're from a different country, even though it's the same language, and they know precisely that you're from Canada or Quebec. And yeah, so it's kind of fun, actually.
So have you lived in the U.S.? You live there now, right?
Yeah, my primary residence is in the U.S. I'm a dual citizen. I moved to the U.S. in 1995, Super Bowl Sunday, in fact, 95.
Was that the Bears?
I don't even remember. I should look that up. Okay. I don't even remember because I was on a plane. I was in the tech industry with my technology degree. I was in the tech industry most of my career, in fact, working in cellular rollouts, telecommunication, internet, the internet growth, and so on and so forth over the years. You know, all roads, when you're a computer science major, electrical engineer, all roads lead to Silicon Valley. And that's where I ended up in 95, and I've been there ever since.
So give us just a little sense of what you do today at JTC.
Yeah, so JTC is a company that's really focused on helping our clients live their values. And so that's a pretty broad statement, right? We are 1,200 people strong. We're publicly traded on the London Exchange. We're in 23 different countries. We have a private client business, so essentially high net worth individuals, family offices that we provide services to. We also have a big institutional practice where we provide administrative services to companies trying to raise money. So funds, basically, private equity or private equity real estate and so on. So I, up until very recently, have been running the U.S. business of that company. We were acquired by JTC 3 years ago. And the division of the company that I ran was building fund administration solutions for well-intended funds. So ESG funds, impact funds, and that's how we got into opportunity zones where you and I, through which you and I connect. But prior to that, EB5. You know, my view is these types of funds are really specialty funds. The investors have different motivations. The funds have different objectives. But at the, at its core, it's still accounting and financial reporting and those types of things. So we've tried to develop some secret sauce there, which we can talk about if your audience is interested. And that's what I've been doing.
Let me step back and take a big picture view here. And it sounds like you've had, I mean, obviously engineering, software development, that kind of stuff has been central to what you do. But and you don't need to reveal your age or anything like that. But how would you best describe kind of where you're at in your life journey? So an existential maybe type of a question here.
Well, I hope I hope I have at least 50% of my life journey left in me, but okay, I think that would be a tough one to achieve. But in terms of maturity, I certainly I'm certainly only there. I like to think that there's always more, and there's always room for growth and learning. It's a really tough question to ask. I was thinking about it from a career perspective. You know, I don't think I've reached sort of the high point or high level of my career yet. You know, when I was starting out, it was really about, can I learn what I'm supposed to learn? Can I make a difference? Yeah. And then somewhere along the line, it transitions to, can I get promoted? Can I get a raise? And can I acquire these assets or lifestyle?
Yep.
And, you know, now I think I'm at a point where, you know, it's more values driven, I guess. Am I doing something that's important or I think is important? And that's kind of the way it is with life, you know, on the life side too. My kids are all grown, they're married, they moved away. You know, I have seven grandchildren, one more on the way.
Wow.
We got married really young, by the way. and so, you know, on the life side, it's now about spending more time with them and enjoying the things we've collectively worked for and built. So probably a lousy answer to your question, but I think I'm still figuring it out, to be honest with you.
Do you know how and when you kind of shifted to, in your words, you know, focus a little maybe on more on values, maybe hear other people talk about from success to significance. I don't know, maybe that's another way to say it. Do you know when that transition happened for you? And is there any aha moments around that?
Well, it was later in life than I guess I would have liked. You know, Silicon Valley, you do these startups, you build them, you grow them rapidly, you try to make an exit of some kind, and then you go and you do it again. And, you know, I've been doing that for 20 years before this recent one where JTC acquired us. And I think what you learn in that process is that at some point you're on a, it's kind of going fast and the world's going fast and you sort of go, you know what, this is fun and all of that, but there's other stuff going on. So it was somewhere in the last half of my, or the latter part of my career where I think I got more wise, if that makes sense.
Yeah. When I turned 40, so I'll disclose, I'll be 50 this year, but when I was turning 40, there was a series of events that impacted me, and I won't go through it all, but ultimately kind of the straw that broke the camel's back in my experience was ultimate back surgery. And it forced me to be still for the first time in 20 some odd years at that point. And you, for me, you wake up and you're like, all right, so if I die, whatever, with an extra, pick whatever number you want in your bank account, does it really matter? Especially I was a workaholic and all that kind of stuff. And so it's just interesting how it seems like generally people get to this point and go, yeah, the earthly stuff just doesn't carry its weight. And I don't know how, and maybe it's just a normal cycle of life, but I don't know how you get individuals to recognize that. And there's nothing wrong with part of this, but just getting that metaphoric house with a white picket fence, it ultimately doesn't fulfill you. Now it's great to have and whatnot, but fortunate for me, mine was when I was 40. So, you know, I still, Lord willing, have a number of years to go at it, but it is interesting to talk to people when they make that transition. So I appreciate you sharing a little bit about it.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating thing. You know, our private client business, the expression is time is the new luxury. And you get to the point where you start to realize that, right? The more things you sort of acquire, or the more assets you build up, the more wealth you build up, the more things you have to worry about and take care of, right? Yep. And you sort of get to a point where that clicks in your mind, and you want time, and you can't buy time. So you have to start making other adjustments, right?
It's funny you say that, because we ultimately downsized our house, which has been great from a mental perspective. And we went through this whole thing, just like what you said. It's like the more stuff you have, just the more time and chaos it creates. Although I have also found ourselves 10 years removed from that, it's easy to slip back into that mode. And, you know, like, we bought some land that's, you know, 45 minutes away from here. It's nothing special, but we go out there and do bonfires and putz around. And every time you add, I mean, on one hand, it's wonderful, but it's like, oh, geez, I just made
this. Now I got to go take care of
it. I got to go mow this stupid thing. Yeah.
So, exactly right.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. This is a big question. But in light of this whole significance time thing, how are you trying to change the world today? Whether that be big or whether it be small, I'd just be curious what's in your brain on, you know, how you're trying to leave a legacy or make a difference.
I'm just trying to make a positive difference in some way, honestly. I don't have a vision to change the world, but maybe by changing or making a positive difference every day in a little way, you ultimately, and if everybody does that, you ultimately get there. So sort of, I think you said it, you know, you're trying to leave it a little better than when you found it, right? And this gets back to the question sort of about career and life's mission and so on that you were asking before. You know, it's in my career now, I really am much more focused on trying to do things that align with values, right? So let's talk about EB-5 immigration. EB-5 is an example, right? So, you know, I'm an immigrant to the United States. I believe this is the greatest country in the world, and I wanted to be part of that. It provides so many opportunities, has great standard of life. It's free. maybe it feels a little less free than it did 20 years ago, but that's a political path we can go down. Yeah. But in general, it's the freest country in the world, and you can achieve whatever you want to achieve, right? So to me, I just am so passionate, excited about having been blessed with this opportunity through my education and career to being able to come down here. Mm-hmm. So now I want to use that to make a difference. And one way is, you know, we've been really trying to help in the EB-5 world, which, for those who don't know, is a job creation program at its core, implemented by Congress in the 1990s. Foreign investors invest in initiatives that create U.S. full-time permanent jobs. And there's a certain threshold to meet. And if it's successful, they're entitled to get their whatever return on their capital in the deal they made. Of course, it's at risk, so they could lose it. But if it creates the jobs, then they can get a green card, right? So it's a wonderful thing that attracts very talented and gifted people to this country. The best job creation program ever. It's created hundreds of thousands of jobs, and it costs the U.S. taxpayer nothing. That's the kind of thing I want to be involved with. Mm-hmm. Let's help those investors succeed. Let's help protect their money. Let's make sure they're actually creating the jobs that they're supposed to, and do this thing the right way. Since that, I've been kind of looking for similar things like that that we can get involved in. And Opportunity Zones was when we jumped all over, right? I was blown away by the presentation our friends at EIG did about health and life outcomes based on where you live and the conditions around where you live. So that really moved me. And we developed another solution to try to make sure that program continues as long as it possibly can. It's funny, back to politics really quickly. It's right. It's funny how a great idea like opportunity zones, the minute it's pushed out there, so many people are saying, let's kill this thing. It's another tax gift for the rich and all that. So our approach has been, well, let's prove that it's actually doing the good it's intended to do. And if it is, let's keep it going. If it's not, okay, we'll tweak it, right? Or we'll end it, what have you. So that's what I'm trying to do in one little way, trying to make these things better, make them work.
And I know you're being humble, but I actually think it's more than just a little way. So I just commend you for what you guys are doing. We were involved in the Opportunity Zone very early. Again, not really come. I mean, yes, we have an investment mindset, so that's always the case. But originally, we were drawn to it because of just the impact that this capital could have on these communities. And you are right. If you actually look at the way that program was researched and set up, and nothing's ever perfect, you're like, this actually can move the needle. And so it's really frustrating when you have a government come together, bipartisan, try to come up with solutions, and then people are shooting it down. And of course, then you get people who will abuse it and whatnot. But once you get through all that mess, there still is, like, in the case of opportunity zones, there's still a real unique opportunity that's a win, potentially a win-win for everybody. And frankly, I think we need more of that in the system. So I don't know if this next question will tie into anything you just said. You know, you've obviously been in Silicon Valley, you're doing what you're doing today. When did you realize the power of capital? And maybe what does that mean to you?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think it was Silicon Valley that taught me that lesson and drilled it home. You know, I was really fortunate, I think, being in the telecommunications part of the technology sector during the digital revolution, right? Where the cellular networks were being rolled out globally. You know, there were things that maybe your listeners will laugh, but, you know, when voicemail came into be, what a game changer in terms of productivity. Fax machines, what a game changer in terms of productivity and ease of life and all of that sort of stuff. It's still amazing. You know, I'm old enough that back in my first sort of sales job, I'd go to the local library to pull out books of company listings and who was running these different companies. And then you'd write them down on a paper and send letters to these people, right? Think about that. It's just, and think about where we are today, you know, with marketing automation and all these things. So really blessed to see all of these things and have been involved with all of these things. But Silicon Valley teaches you the value of capital because you got to have a well-funded company and you've got to have good, strong backers behind you that are willing to invest and take some risk and ride the ups and downs. I mean, you run a small business. We haven't talked about this, but I'm sure you've adjusted and pivoted and changed your plan and your approach as you've learned. And that takes capital to be able to ride those things out. And so what happens in Silicon Valley, of course, is those that are the best ideas or the best inventions don't always survive and don't always win. You have to have a combination of the right capitalization and a good idea. And that was the thing that I learned going through Silicon Valley. You can have the greatest idea in the world and the coolest product ever. But if you don't have the money to get that idea out there, build the product, market it, it doesn't matter. You know, I don't have visibility into all the things that have failed over time, but I'm sure there's some great things that never found the light of day that would have had a really positive impact on the world.
What does stewardship mean to you?
Yeah, leadership by example, I think, is what that means to me.
Okay.
You know, as I've gotten older, try to listen better. Try to really understand what people are saying. And I'm really lucky because being on sort of the marketing or business development side of that company, I get to talk to a lot of people who have really interesting ideas. And those ideas, you know, you can piece them together. Sometimes you don't have ultimate clarity of, okay, this is a direction we should go. You know, I manage a lot of people at this company and it's not always clear that we're on the right path, you know. I jokingly say I'm often wrong, but I'm never in doubt, you know. but you know, half the battle sometimes is leading based on your gut and believing. And so leading by example and you adjust by listening and learning, I guess, is what I would say.
So what I know, one of the things, because you and I have had discussions about this previously, is you have done a survey in this broader impact values alignment investing space. Any learnings there that may be of interest to our listeners, as well as you guide your business in this space, any nuggets that you'd be willing to share with us?
Yeah, that's a really good example, actually, of stewardship in a way, right? Because we do these surveys to try to listen and learn and use the information to develop solutions or help move the industry forward. So the purpose of this survey that you so kindly helped us with, thank you, was really to listen and learn about impact investing. And hopefully, well, I'm certain actually that that will lead to some additional product offerings or service offerings from us. But also, I think probably even more importantly, it'll help us sort of achieve that mission of trying to get the narrative on track so that naysayers don't kill this. An obvious example is bad karma, bad vibe that the term ESG has out there right now, right? There are state and local governments telling companies to stop doing ESG or telling pension funds, their pension funds, not to invest in things that are ESG because ESG is bad and evil, I guess. And so some of the survey questions, and I know this is a topic you're passionate about too, you know, some of these survey questions sort of tried to draw out, well, what is going on with that? And it turns out, I think, that ESG isn't the issue. It's that ESG really, when we use that term, we're really not talking about outcomes. The vast majority of people want a positive outcome from their investment. That's what impact investing is all about. So the use of the terminology, that's one thing we learned, right? People really don't understand the difference. Mm-hmm. There's hundreds and hundreds of frameworks out there. People really don't get what they are. They've heard of them, but they don't really get what they are. Younger people, this is sort of obvious, are much more passionate about this than boomers like me. Mm-hmm. Not to say I'm not passionate about it, but it's just a generational thing, right? So the key takeaway from me, and there's four or five other things, Jeff, we could sure. talk about, but the key takeaway really is that this is a movement, towards, you know, you can make an investment and do good at the same time is a movement. And I think eventually that's what investing will be, right? Just like I evaluate the financial return, I'll evaluate the impact. And so maybe we'll stop talking about impact 5 years from now and it'll just be investing.
Obviously, I've drunk the Kool-Aid, but I've got my own capital in this yeah. movement. But it's interesting. So I originally started my career at Van Kampen, which is a mutual fund company, UIT company, back in the mid 90s. And the question that was being addressed there, this was around unit investment trust, was will people actually buy a basket of unmanaged securities, whether it's, and it had been done big time with bonds, and then would it be done with equities? Well, that question got answered, and ultimately it was the ETF model that then, you know, took that to trillions of dollars. So that was the first question that I got to watch in my career. The second question was, will people actually put other things in their portfolio other than stocks and bonds, you know, and that's with alternatives. And that really has been answered. And I think what you just described is actually the third question that people are asking right now is, will people bring their value set into the investment process, recognizing that they want to align their own values and then make sure that the capital is aligning with others, you know, planet, others appropriately. And I think to what you just said and what I'm betting on is that people will say, yeah, I do want to integrate that into my investing. And look, the truth is, most people, if you go to them and say, hey, here's an investment, you're going to make X return, but it's probably not going to be great for people. Most are not like, oh, I want to do that. The challenge is most people have this notion, at least in the US, if I'm doing something good, I can't make money. And my response back to them was, wait, so every time you make money on something, are you doing something bad? And the answer is no, but there's just this retraining that somehow, as soon as you bring in heart or your values, that you have to be soft. And it's like, yeah. I don't think it has to be that way.
I think you're right, 100% right. And, you know, this is back to the survey. This is the second year that we've done that, that survey. And that second point you just made about the perception of impact investing, there seems to be movement towards people who believe, I don't have to give up yield to do good with an investment. That's having an impact we're seeing in the opportunity zone space. You and I have talked about this. You know, early on, nobody was talking about the impact, right, except maybe you.
Right.
They're all talking about the tax incentive. Right. Now it's much more impact forward than it was. And on the values point, I think that's the secret sauce, honestly, is positioning your fund to align with whatever the value is. Don't try to be all to all people, right? And that's another thing that comes through loud and clear in the survey. And I'm just thinking about it now. Maybe that's the problem with ESG. It's sort of this big thing.
So broad.
Yeah.
Well, think about it. It's environmental, it's social and governance. Right. But that's like, it's massive. Right. If anything, if it isolated for a second, I've never thought, you know, if this fund or this company, you know, is all around the E, well, you can get your arms around that. But when you start, it's big.
Yeah. And even the E, to the point you're making in our survey, what you'll find out is, well, some people care about clean drinking water. Other people care about carbon reduction. Others care about renewable energy. And that's the level it needs to be at. On the social side, you know, it's homeless or mental health or whatever. That's where the investors' heads are, I think.
Well, and I think, and I don't know that anybody did this on purpose, but I think what's happened, I was looking at my 27 years of doing this, investments there's been a veil and a wall put between your capital and your investment and what it's doing. And you know, look at ETFs, you can go figure out what's inside an ETF, for example. But you're not really talking about what that capital is doing. And so to your point, I think the more people can actually get connected to what their capital is doing through stories, through data, especially around things they're passionate about, the interest level and the commitment to that. In my world, we say you actually get to experience joy and freedom around investing other than just the normal fears of or emotions of fear and greed. You know, like I've invested in affordable housing, go through the, you know, pandemic, and that population group as everybody got impacted. And so on one hand, my investment, you're like, oh, how's it doing? Well, they actually had to suspend the dividends for, I don't remember, a quarter or two.
Wow.
But in doing that, they actually were really trying to take care of the residents. And I would argue that community is a stronger community, therefore making my investment stronger, even if I had to suspend a dividends for a quarter or two.
Right. That's really cool.
Last question. And this is, this is always hard. I love this question because it's hard. If you could have a dream come true for your life, what would it be? And if it's helpful, you could exclude family dynamics because you're never going to say the right thing there. So however you want to answer in case your family.
You know, as I was thinking about this podcast, I said to my team in California, you know, I've never been asked questions like this before in a podcast. You're right. It's actually hard, but honestly, it's a lot of fun at the same time. You know, and you're right. It is hard to answer. I would really say, first of all, it's pretty easy to say if there was one dream come true, it would be family related, not work related.
Yep.
And I think at the end of the day, when I leave this planet, I want to think that my family thought I was the best father I could possibly be, the best husband I could possibly be, the best grandparent I could possibly be, son, et cetera. Right. Yep. I think that's it. And it's, I don't know if I can define it any further than that, Jeff.
There is a book, and I think it's called Living Forward, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Basically, you start with writing your epitaph or your eulogy or whatever it is.
Yeah, right.
And then the exercise at that point is, all right, where are the disconnects between how I want to remember it and how I'm actually living?
Right.
So you know, everything you just mentioned is exactly the things that I put in, the, you know, as I did this exercise. And then the humbling part is to go, I probably could do a little better here. Could do a little bit better here.
Yeah.
Although that does make life and the journey well worth it, especially when you're trying to move towards those types of things. So
right. No, I get it. And being here in Jersey to bring it full circle is a good reminder of that, because they're very polite, especially polite drivers. They don't have the road rage that we have in the U.S. And so you pretty quickly sort of see yourself in a different light when you compare yourself to them. So
did my wife happen to call you or something to make that comment? No. I don't have road rage, but I am not patient. People don't put their blinkers on. And it's funny. It is just that one little thing is a great reminder to go, really? Am I helping myself get to work sooner? Okay, whatever. Maybe it's 45 seconds. Who cares? And the stress that I just created for myself and others. Doggone it, Reed, you challenged me this morning, but I love it.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Anything else you'd like to share with the listeners before we sign off?
Well, I appreciate what you're doing. I appreciate what you're doing in ADESA to help bring this issue forward. I'm very appreciative that we've had the chance to work together and look forward to doing more. So I just encourage the listeners to keep following you and listen to the podcast, because you're doing great things.
Well, I appreciate it. And we need many more people to join in like you're doing, because it's and look, we're seeing it happen. I mean, in my kind of 10-year transition into this, where we are today versus 10 years ago has been a radical shift. And for those who are listening, you actually don't have to give up on your capitalistic views.
Right.
You actually integrate this in there. Now, a few things may get challenged, but I do think you can come to the table fully engaged from an intellectual standpoint, investment standpoint, and from a heart standpoint, and make 100%. Money and as well, do good. So, Reed, we appreciate you taking the time and willingness to share with our listeners. Thank you for what you all are building that will ultimately help funds, reporting, administrative. I mean, on one hand, it's kind of boring, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but it's really critical. And I actually think on your end, the more that you can help investors as they look at their holdings, not only be able to articulate what they own, but being able to show and display the impact that they're having, that's a massive opportunity to keep this movement going. So however you guys can do that, I'd encourage you to keep working on that.
Well, I think that's right. And at the end of the day, what we've found is when we do that for funds, the more reporting, transparency, communication, if you will, in terms of what the investment is actually doing and what the mission really is, the faster they raise capital. And so that's what it's all about.
Which is so ironic, because what does the world want? They want transparency. They want all that stuff. And so what you realize, if you actually are doing good things and great things and striving to, and you're transparent, you're rewarded for that.
That's right. 100%.
So it's interesting. Well, don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. Please rate us and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. That will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on a path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer. Until next time, Reed, thank you so much. This was fun.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.